If what? No. The huh? I'll explain in a minute. Let's deal with some positions beyond Dallas. Today is a wrap-up, so no questions. Please do not interrupt any given thinker, because it'll be too fragmented. I want to introduce a number of names to you. The first approach would be a more romantic approach, and the classic Jewish work of that would be Shai Agnon standing at Sinai. He collected all the Midrashim dealing with Mamad Har Sinai. Yes, one could have considered it a historic position, but it's not that, as he basically, you know, collected everything in Chazal, in the Rishonim, that they say about Mamad Har Sinai, but without asking any philosophic questions. It's romantic in the sense that at this point it's only a sensibility. It's only a sense, meaning it's not that you're saying you believe in every one of these texts. It doesn't mean that these texts answer any all philosophic questions. But you're really opting out of the questions by taking a romantic stance, like it's now meaningful to you as literature, it's meaningful to you to poetically. These texts speak to you, but it doesn't mean you want to formulate anything from it. That's the classic romantic approach. You know, whether it's, you know, Bialik's Sefer HaAgadah, Book of Legends, or Agnon standing at Sinai. Chazal is still important to you, not because you want to defend every line or you even want to question every line, but because you still want to respect Chazal. Now, that was a position pushed away by most of the thinkers we did in this course, because they wanted a real answer to Revelation. So no, did Revelation occur? What does it mean? Just to say, oh wow, this is a great, fantastic midrash, was not sufficient for most people. Now, hold on. In the last decades, last 15, 20 years, there's a new position that's come to be called the post-liberal position. And just hold off while I explain this position a minute. The post-liberal position, which really got started through a group of divergent professors at Yale, is also called the position of second naivete. It says you stop asking the big questions of Revelation or any other philosophic question, and you now ask, and you now accept it as a second naivete. You accept what goes on in the texts. It is no longer for you to judge. Some figures associated with this include one, Yaroslav Pelikan. Just remember the name Pelikan. P-E-L-I-K-A-N. And he says what counts is the Bible not as the first of a sequence, assuming that just the Bible is equal to everything that came afterwards, but it becomes the typology and model for all tradition afterwards. So we look at the function of Revelation, that it molds the thousands of years of culture since that point. And he put out many books of, you know, this through the centuries and that through the centuries, showing how each age interpreted a basic text based on that era. The most important of this circle, who we don't have time to explain in detail, is George Lindbeck, who put out a book called The Nature of Doctrine, in which I'm not going to go into technical points. But George Limbeck said religion is not a doctrine. It's not an experience. Religion is textuality. And when I say I am a Christian, it means I accept Christian scripture. So the difference between a believer and a non-believer is not that one accepts doctrine and the other doesn't, or that one person has a religious experience and the other doesn't. The difference between a believer and not is that do you use this canon of texts to understand your reality or not? Or even the differences between one religion and the other is not one is true, one is false, but one uses New Testament, one uses Talmud, one uses Hadith and Sharia. Limbeck was subjected to a series of back and forth articles by Dulles. Dulles wrote, Dulles losing all cool, attacking Limbeck, saying, if all you're doing is accepting texts, then you're just another dogmatist. Of which Limbeck wrote back and says, no, I am not taking any position about what occurred or about experience or doctrine or anything else. I'm just saying I understand my world through this rubric of texts. He's not dealing with the issue. So then you get back to further critique. Oh, so you're one of those postmoderns that don't believe in truth anymore. And he writes back, no, I am not a postmodern. I am a firm believer in the texts. But I'm a post-liberal. Meaning I don't believe in the liberal sense in which there is a universal revelatory position anymore, or universal philosophic position. In the end, all we could come down to is our cultural, our particular, our ethnic texts, and that's what we have to accept. Dulles writes back another article saying, no, you misunderstand what happens to human experience. You are completely squelching it all. There is some point that Limbeck is very good for allowing you to accept a broad range of texts, of allowing you to set, because all of the positions we did until now let you pick and choose between texts to build your construct. Limbeck says you accept all of them and you don't get involved between picking and choosing of them. Or in other words, Limbeck would say, you may, to give the Jewish example, if you are wedded to the Talmud and rabbinic literature, that is your definition. Revelation means to you that you accept having to make sense out of Masechet Shabbos, out of Mechilta, and all of it, and Midrash Rabbah, rather than taking any specific stance.
What does it mean if you post that?
What? Because you're not going to come and say, oh, my belief in rational arguments or science or history overtakes my fundamental commitment to these texts. Okay? I bring it out because Dulles really dislikes this position. Others associated with this position include Hans Fry, The Eclipse of Biblical Narrative. Now, Hans Fry's position says that in the time of the medievals, they did not believe of any understanding of the Bible outside of its own narrative sense. There was a Sikuro Shel Mikra, a narrative sense of the stories, meaning I understand Abraham, I understand Yaakov, I understand Moshe. But that wasn't seen as corresponding to historic reality. It wasn't seen as corresponding to external events. It was an automatic internal acceptance of the logic of the Bible by itself. If you want a summary of Hans Frey's position, one day in whatever fit of frustration, I actually wrote a summary of Frey, and it's posted on LookChat. You can go find, is that they were discussing about whether the flood existed or not, and how does it correspond to historic reality, and I submitted like an 8-page summary of the post-liberal position through Frey on LookChat. They also reprinted it in St. Dot.
Is this like a blog comment
that you posted and printed in a journal? If it has a blog comment of 8 pages. It was like the novelty of me just coming in like some, you know, just entering this discussion back and forth, me coming in and giving this 8-page comment, which just like, you know, okay, that ended the discussion.
Those other discussions can get kind of frustrating.
Yeah.
Right. So
I can see the imbalance.
So there's one day, it was like a winter Sunday, and I just like, you know, came in. So you can get a good summary of it online. What? On LookChat, try typing in his reaction to Joe Olowowski on the flood. That's, I think it's a posted on there. I know it's still up there somewhere. About 5 years ago or something. About 5 or 6 years ago. pre-blog, because the point is now I know to keep out of everything. That was just like, you know, okay, here's the new media. You're going to do this. I'm going to give you an 8-page response. Since nobody really wants 8-page responses, now I just keep quiet. Not that I haven't been tempted to write 5 or 6 page responses to things. So that's just not the medium of blogs. Okay. So
it's the one thing I read.
Okay, so Frey is worth getting to know, but it's a difficult book written somewhat Germanically. Okay. Now let's get to the next position. Fakhri. Fakhri is a student of Dulles, but rather than being Catholic, he's evangelical Protestant. His book is a required reading many places in the country at this point, which is why a lot of you were able to get copies for 50 cents. Still waiting for them to come in, but that shows you how prevalent of a textbook it is. He reframes our discussion, and this is where we're going to go forward. Now, evangelicals want to preserve the biblical doctrine. So what he does He reframes these from possibilities into all of them being there, meaning. Okay, so we have the thing is if we're looking like through a telescope at the doctrine is only understood through tradition, which is only understood through history, which is only understood through ourselves, through our narrative, through our human experiences. Meaning rather than making it an either-or choice like Dulles seems to make it, Fakhri combined everything and said, no, even if revelation has to make sense to me today and has to be true to tradition, but I'm still understanding the doctrine. So what this really frames is that revelation does not become free-floating like in the fifth category, and it doesn't become all singularly doctrinal like position number one. Instead, saying that even if you held position number one, the doctrinal, if you want a sophisticated version of it, You better understand that you understand all texts through self, and through history, and through tradition, and that's the only way it all works together. So it's position number one, the doctrinal. If you want to minor repair it, you have to then ask, so how can we take Weinberg or Rivarin's position and combine it with elements of 3 and 5 to be more sensitive to the human elements? Or if you want to reformulate Heschel or Hooke, how can we bring in greater human and historic and doctrinal elements in order to really be the fullest and truest to our traditions? That's his opening. Now, this book is an interesting book, is that the later chapters read like his retelling of where he differs from Dulles, and assumes he read Dulles. But the opening chapter is really like, okay, let's discuss this through. In what order should these be? How do we go about reformulating this? How do we now say which elements from which, what can be left out? Does everything have to be there? Or just more sophisticated, is it 3 or is it 4? So what is that? In this chapter, the intro in chapter 1 seems to be a separate book than the rest of it, which got written as his actual lectures. Now, before I go on with what he said, does anyone have any thoughts on this or anything of how you would reformulate some of the material we did in light of this? Yes?
Just like a general question, like how does he deal with the fact that not only is doctrine mediated through history, but doctrine is not a static term, it changes with history. The self deals with a different history than every other self.
He would hold that there is still some common core, some element that remains, and that's what we're going to go through why he holds this, is that in some way, that's why I did this order, in some sort of textual level, no matter what you want to say, we saw Rabbi Akiva being used differently by Weinberg, by Heschel, by Levinas, by Rav Kook. You still are stuck with that Rav Kook. You're still stuck with that Rabbi Akiva, even if you say it's a floating category, and he's willing to go with this. He's not willing to throw everything out. He's not...
But don't you just have to ask...
He still wants to be firmer. He may disagree with that. You may want to be whatever you want to be, but he's clearly trying to maintain a on the quite conservative end of the evangelical end of the American spectrum.
But just like, my question is, that we were thinking chapter endings for chit, like for actual content, like, okay, I understand, we all agree, like, we need to use this chapter ending called Rabbi Akiva, we need to use this key line. That doesn't, you know, that means so differently tomorrow.
And the answer is, from his point of view, there's still some core of what that's saying, and then what frames the Jewish tradition, and that's why he's going to write a defense of position number 2, in that all users of Rabbi Akiva have to discuss about how Torah, from a Jewish point of view, is infinite. It's not doctrinal like Thomas Aquinas. But where the infinity for position number 1 of Weinberger or Ruthenstein is located in the Talmud Chachamim and Gedolim and the Beis Medrash, and where for Heschel and Rav Kook it's located in human experience, and for Levinas it's located in the reader, then the point is that infinity and how that inflects the way we read text does remain a core. Yes?
But if you're old school yeshivas, you could just say that infinity was to them, for us it's just a high.
Okay, so then you're holding a pure version, he doesn't. He wants to bring together the best of all of these. That's really what I want to push you in thinking about, you know, can you bring these together? Because now that I've created absolute, complete separate categories, that's why his book is such a bestseller now. Okay, so let's now refactor it and say, no, we can blur the categories, but what do we have at this point? Yes?
What's the difference between history and tradition again?
Okay, history would mean, give the Jewish example, not the Christian one, it would mean Israel, Eretz Israel, Jewish history of persecution, our historic view of it being an event that created obvious morale leading to who we are. While tradition is what we call Masara, the idea that there is a Torah Shabbat Peh and Chachamim who are vested with interpretation.
Okay, so.
I mean, you can reverse. The question is, from our point of view, it doesn't really matter if you reverse the order here, but this is your interpretation. You'll interpret it through an interpretive tradition. You'll only interpret Chazal through Rishonim or whatever you think the tradition means. While this is history in the sense that there is a people created in Matan Torah that now becomes Am Yisrael.
Why is that a lens in which you view doctrine? Why is the student to be part of it?
Because this would be saying that, look, I like Eliezer Berkowitz's position that what Revelation was an event that created Am Yisrael and gave him a mission of mitzvot. But you can say that Berkowitz is anemic when you think about his theories of Torah Shabbat Peh and Beit Midrash, so they maybe need to be complemented by a more Beit Midrash philosophy. And you can say Beit Midrash philosophies are rather anemic when it comes to dealing with the historic elements and the personal elements.
But then it would seem then that you should really have two structures, one with doctrine at the bottom and then self and tradition, and another one with history at the bottom and then self and tradition.
Okay, he does this. He puts it all at any one point when something comes out of our mouth, what does it mean today? All of them play a role.
Four by all four.
They're all four, or four, five, or all six, or all 12, or whatever. They all play a role. Yes.
So if you walk into a room where one of them says, you can't know God if you don't turn to Torah.
Yeah.
If you don't spend your life studying Torah, you're never going to know God, and rather you won't get into Abba.
Yeah.
And another guy says, no, you can know God by playing guitar.
Right.
And what will he say?
The answer, that's what I'm going to get to, is that playing guitar is not it. But if you then want to say it's Rav Nachman or Ishvitz and guitar playing and all this and Matas Yahu that's going to inform your life of the Beis Medrash and it's going to inform the way Torah is going to play itself out, that you can say.
They're still not
on the guitar. What? Oh, that's what. Okay, so now you're asking specifically. This is chapter number, I think, whatever, chapter 3 in his book. So I was like, he actually addressed that for a full chapter, yes.
Would it be correct that since the last translation just had the arrow on the bottom?
That's right.
Start with Zach and then get
the. That's right. Yes.
Just one more question with the arrow.
Yeah.
What does the arrow represent? Revelation?
Your perspective of looking.
Arrow to me. So there's another arrow coming from a Kaddish Baruch or something called Revelation that's going into the Akramas.
Yeah, he gives you alternate little charts there. But my limited drawing, that's as far as I can get. Okay, so let's get, I think this is chapter 3, and we now get to Mr. Unterman's question. For chapter 3, Bakri introduces a distinction that's very prevalent now in interreligious discussions between general revelation and specific revelation. General revelation is how do you know God and God's Word through creation, through our very humanity. And whether you think that is mysticism, drugs, guitar playing, philosophic study, moral dimensions, but all those universals that the Rav had in the beginning of Ubakashta Misham, Bakri will call general revelation. They apply to all humanity from Adam, from Adam. They apply to all humanity from Noah. His model for understanding general revelation is Tillich. That position, Dulles' position number 5 is great for understanding the general human condition. But the problem with it for Fakhri is that there is no specific revelation for your religion there. You know, if I can be a Buddhist or play guitar, then I don't need organized religion. I don't need all these faith claims. I don't need any of it. So basically, he calls all of them general revelation.
In a dull sense?
No, in section 5. Meaning all those, the Tillich, the Universals, the William James, the beginnings of 3 and 5.
It's the 3 and 5, what? Those models.
Yes. And he distinguishes that from what he calls special revelation, which are all these other elements. So that kind of answers your question in a rather full way. That all of the other, meaning models 1, 2, and the more religious, 1, 2, 4, and the religious versions of models 3 and 5 are special revelation. Why your religion is unique that God spoke to you, as opposed to the general revelation.
So what it means to talk to the arrow, I also understand
what you said. Is that that's a good way to understand Tillich, not to reject it, but to say that these discussions about the ultimate in life, our ultimate concern, our quest for the transcendent, Lord, get me high, play guitar, are part of our general coming to God as being humans, but not our specific revelation as Yisrael and Har Sinai.
What's it called when you take these two approaches?
What?
What's it called when you take these two approaches? What,
a general and special revelation? That's just a general term, that's just what the words are. There's no.
Would it be a pluralist?
No. He's not sitting in the pluralist position at all. The special revelation is now how do you deal in our case with Har Sinai? And for this, if you want to know why Har Sinai is important, hold open questions. Then he says position number 4 of Dulles, Karl Barth position, was the strongest for clubbing you over the head to realize why guitar playing is not enough and you must have a real revelation. That there clearly is a prior word, a knowledge given from God. He then says, what is that knowledge? And he's going to now describe in chapter 6 why he remains an evangelical and why he accepts the doctrinal, literal, verbal, inerrant inspiration. What's good about chapter 6 of Fakhri is you get to see where the Jewish position is so different than the Christian one. Because he will show you that all the proof texts that Scripture is inerrant and entirely revealed are only from the New Testament. If you look at how whatever the Chumash says about itself, you get texts about, oh, this was an old Divrei HaYamim, this is Yahav Sufo, this is a separate shear, possibly it's Megillah Nitna. You had all these statements in Chumash describing the process are a much more complex process than what Christians have to deal with of saying here is the word and it's the unerrant word. So we're going to come back to those Jewish statements when we deal with the questions of biblical criticism. But when you just collect out Chumash and the Chazals on those lines, the problem of revelation, or try to say, the problem of revelation in the 20th century has really blinded us to the incredible richness of Chazal, of them considering every possibility of were there prior books written by the Avot that were incorporated into Torah at Moshe? Where was Torah at Moshe even after Ahol Moed? Were there continuous later things? Where does Eldad or Medad fit in the Zakanim? Why are there inverted nuns? Was that a separate sefer that got lost? Was the Varim some other status? There's a rich literature out there that in the Jewish text about what the Bible is, But since we are so busy either answering the philosophic question of revelation, like Dulles presented, or like we went through all these thinkers, those approaches really fell out of the 20th century. There are almost no good 20th century discussions of McGill and McGillaninda. There are a few. The few people who do, we'll come back to later, will be Schneer Lyman in a few articles, and Rav Kasher, but nothing truly extensive that really builds it up into a full theory. And those Jews that are not worried about revelation were worried about biblical criticism, and therefore trying to either defend against or make little small leeways to allow you to engage in small elements of it, rather than actually putting together what was the rabbinic position. Because if you held the position of Chazal, that the Torah was given in scroll by scroll to Moshe, that doesn't help you either become a bit of a critic or defend against it. It's its own separate trajectory of what our self-understanding of the text is. So I don't know, did any of your intro to Bibles deal with those issues in any extensive way? A little bit, but his whole goal is to deal with the biblical criticism question, not what did Chazal actually textually mean. What? No, okay. So we'll come back to that. Yes?
So what about within the Gospels, this crazy, there's a lot of differences.
Oh, like I say, they have it much harder, and by the time you're done reading chapter 6, you're going to learn the opposite side, why we have it much easier than they do, and we, you know, why we really have a much more fluid approach, and that as much as a lot of you like Rav Kook or Heschel or others who were influenced by Chazal, but none of them were really wanting to go put it together, what does Chazal really say? So if some of you really want to bring in self-mysticism and tradition, after you're done with Fakhri, you can still say, okay, so what is the doctrine you're looking at? It still could be that the Dvarim was still three, the Midbar was three Svarim, and Megillah and Megillanitna, and there were prior books of the patriarchs, and all sorts of things that are only, you know, alluded to for their own needs by Rav Kook and Heschel and others.
Would that change anything in terms of what sort of power each of those texts has as far as doctrine goes?
I mean, well, the point is that I'm assuming your paper will let me know.
Isn't it?
Right.
Yes.
Now that you think about it, isn't this basically just like the most level of spiritual power, and then it's like, in the certain sense, it's like a modern understanding
of Torah Shabbat. Okay, so the answer is where we formulated Rav Kook as answering just the question of revelation, and that he's only got really one answer, this very experiential one. But when you put it together now as a bigger theory, the answer is yes. So how does this change and go back to reread the material in light of it? You know, what are the other elements that have to play a role here? What's your theory of Torah Shabbat Peh? What's your theory of the self? What's your theory of Svarim? And then all those things play a role also. So what I'm telling you is, you know, all the more so, and that's why I'm taking a full class to do this, because as much as I got you thinking about five separate approaches, now my goal is to get you to produce good papers to really think about the issues. Yes?
What's the difference between his general and specific revelations and the Rav's two confrontations?
There is that the special revelation almost obliterates the general revelation. And the general revelation becomes just a human quest in which it comes from it, but let me phrase it differently. The special revelation for the Rav obliterates the general, and it doesn't allow you to give any credence to the general. The Rav will let you say all people quest for a transcendence. The Rav would not let you say that Bach Bach, I don't know, pick,
Hikes in the Woods.
What? Hikes in the Woods and Buddhism actually are something implanted by God as a general revelation for us. I mean, this one is allowing you to say that nature, music, self, other religions really are there, and God really wants you to see the divine in them.
But even he doesn't totally do that. Like, he still leaves some. Is there a tradition where the Rav still has this, like, the sediment that's still left behind after the.
The sediment, not only as a secular human, not. This is good because it allows you to say other religions, that God could have still said. All nations can call of God. General revelation allows you to point to what was the religion of Melchizedek and Yitro and Malkut Shva. It allows you to say what is, you know, that there's a universal element given to all people. What? Glove wouldn't allow that. That they basically can have the human experience, but there couldn't be a religion of Yitro and Malkut Shva.
Didn't you say it was in Bernie Banamazeg, right?
What? It is definitely one could work with Banamazeg to. What this is, it's not the same, because what this does is in the 20th century, where Banamazeg still uses a lot of traditional texts and Kabbalah, what Thakri does in a world that doesn't speak Maimonides or Zohar, that doesn't let you do metaphysics anymore, he wants to present these ideas without the metaphysics. Ben-Amazeg is still very Kabbalistic, and this gives you a language that's no longer metaphysical.
If you're saying that God is...
There's a voice to be heard, but there's still a voice to be heard, but you don't have to then say it sparks or it's anything.
You don't really need to explain it, because she doesn't need to say it.
That's right. Yes?
How would a pluralist position deal with that? He's not... He's really like.
Well, Fakhri would say a real pluralist is clearer.
Right, like.
And a pluralist would say Fakhri is an obscurantist. And there's nothing.
He's making too many rules. He's saying up to point X.
Yes,
is okay.
yes.
Where someone like Heck has to say, no, how did they influence me? How is it all dynamic? How is it all flowing?
Yes.
And how do I understand that they're doing, you know, it's not just a static category called the Bodhisattva man.
Yes. So if you wish to write the pluralistic response to Fakhri, that is fine. But as of now, he is now where the field is in terms of sharpening people's minds. People do not find the universal books particularly sharp at this point, and the pluralists are on the defensive when it comes to doctrines of revelation.
I think there, I mean, just not to get too far afield, but there are ways where you could combine it in just as productive a way as it sounds like he's doing. You know,
I didn't disagree, so therefore that could be your role in life.
Every class I get to learn this.
Because you haven't taken one yet. At some point you're going to not get offers anymore. Take one. The next chapter, he talks about the importance of tradition, church, ecclesiology, that you always understand things through tradition. Chapter 8, he comes back and he opens clearly with the fact that the post-liberals find evangelicals too subjective because they think the Bible means whatever they preach. And instead, he then tips his hat and says, yes, the post-liberals may be correct. We may need a greater emphasis on books, tradition, what the text says, and greater than any preaching we do now or use of it is our deference and humility before the text. And that's a little overview. It'll sharpen many of your papers. For those of you who are doing papers that are relevant, it's worth giving the book a glance. They're on order. There are at least 4 copies ordered for the class already, so they'll be floating around. What? Depends where you can go with it. That's what you go with the page. Whether you want to plug the Rav Nas back into the Beit Midrash and doctrine, or you want to know, or you want to plug him into Rav Nachman and Tzedek, the latter you wouldn't need Fakri, the former you would. Okay, another figure of the same approach is Stanley Grenz, who we can do much quicker. Stanley Grenz is going to be similar to Fakhri, but he's going to already start calling reason into question, and he's going to allow much more experience. He's going to come out of a more revivalist Methodist tradition. And the founder of the Methodist, John Wesley, says religion is understood as scripture, reason, experience, and tradition. So he's going to make ever greater place for experience. Your own revival, your own singing, your own summer camp, your own kumzitzes and ebbings, and as being more important for guiding what you do. Another name you should know that I'm not going to go into is Alistair McGath, who's right now the leading evangelical theologian in America, and his books always start off trashing the Enlightenment reason before Revelation. I have less than affinity to his approach, so I cannot do it justice.
Was he
best? The Enlightenment reason, and therefore that's why the only thing left standing is that the Bible is true.
That's the whole punchline?
No. He then becomes, he does the same sophistication post-Dallas, post-everything. But if you already start with a premise that, you know, how can you ever trust those co-framers and Enlightenment figures? I can't. And I'm not the one who can do the correct the defense of that position. But no, he's the leading selling theologian in America today. Alistair McGarth, and Mac, M-A-R-T-H. He puts out about a book a year.
Is there one that you read?
I recommend it on the reading list, Passion for Truth. Not to be confused with Heschel's book in the same title. But at this point, he puts it out so quickly I can't even keep up. Okay. What? Yeah, he's one of those. I mean, the overlap is huge between his books. Our final position is a new offshoot that's been around for a little over a decade. It's called Radical Orthodoxy. Many of my students, or even now Carmi, is flirting with position number 5. The leading protagonist of that is now John Milbank and his book The World, Word Made Strange. Basically, Milbank rejects modernity by going back to the medieval positions and says we have to accept them in all their medieval strangeness. Now that plays a role when my students walk out of my classes saying, of course I believe in the Rambam or his worldview, or I believe in the Zohar, or I believe in the Maharal. And of course modernity is wrong before the Maharal. When anybody, when that moment, there's that moment, whatever it is, toward the end of the course, where you walk out of it with that sort of belief, is now called radical orthodoxy, and is now seen a justified position, in which you now accept the traditional positions in a way that lets them fully critique the modern era. Carmen's version, from what I can tell, was some version of using this to then say, therefore, I don't have to be subservient to history, psychology, sociology, or anything else, because, look, the Sadia, the Ramban, or anyone else wasn't, so why should I?
But he's not actually accepting the Jewish mission.
No, he's not. But he definitely is reading it, and as the years I've been noticing, have a greater influence from that, from reading John Milbank.
Because the influence is that he's now able to not accept modernity, but now that he's going back to
Judaism. No, but there's a point, you can discuss it with him, there's a point that he will use Milbank to the point of then saying, oh, I'm no longer rejecting sociology because I'm holding a dialectic position. I'm rejecting it because the Ramban or Bakhtia or whoever didn't have to deal with it. It's there. What?
Yeah.
I point that out just because some of you are his students also to help you contextualize where that fits in. Yes.
But is this also like a post-decomposition? Like, is he looking at epistemic?
Yes.
Yes. We can
navigate
to that.
That's better.
We're far away. We don't get it. And like,
that's right.
If you're driving a car, you already don't get it.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, he's already coming in. Milbank will already say, we are beyond. You can't. You know, you're in a rupture. They're from nothing in the modern era. You know.
Is that Brian Redd Orthodox?
What? No. Okay. So that is our little introduction, or little point that'll help you with papers. Any questions on this before I now turn us back to the Middle Ages? Think about it. Look it over. I'm going to ask you the question for a minute. From everything we've just did in Dulles, what do you think the strengths and weaknesses are of Dulles, and do you still think there are now weaknesses even in a post Fockery-Grenz perspective? This is important for your papers because it'll get you to think beyond just pigeonholing.
What's the second question?
There's a variant of turning the first one around. Meaning, are there still weaknesses in our typology based on Dulles? Or the other way, are there still elements within Dulles that were not addressed by Fockery, Grenz, and company? Or are there things that are still left over that you think need to be dealt with? Yes?
I feel like it's moved away from a metaphysical question to a literature question.
Yes. That is part of the entire post-liberal turn. The 18th and 20th century asked an epistemological question, how is it possible? The 19th century wanted to say, how do you experience revelation in your life? The 21st century is now getting started with a greater turn to the text and to the literary. That's a good reformulation of what occurred. Yes.
I think I sort of ran most of my stuff for this class because throughout Dulles, I was kind of like on each one, I was saying, well, who really, I mean, like, it doesn't really matter how the revelation itself happens. That's not the central issue of religion.
Okay, for the 20th century, with the critiques of science and analytic philosophy and history and sociology beating down your back, that was the question.
Right.
This is now how do I literarily reformulate the text? And the reason I gave you a whole spectrum of text is because now being on the cusp of a new approach, I want to give you enough tools that know there's likely a book that's going to come out next year or in 3 years from now that's really going to summarize everything that's occurred in the last 20 years, you know, that's going to be now the new approach to taking everyone forward. Yes?
How is this different from Heschel's just taking it like, you know, Moshe is part of our history, as a part of our culture, he's part of our text. You know, he's...
Because for Heschel clearly says Moshe has, about look at how Rabbi Akiva presented the experience of Moshe, that there are different experiential modes. This is not the experiential mode anymore. This is already saying I accept it because I have text of it, and I'm not going to be selective. I have, where Heschel's going to say Rabbi Akiva had black fire and white fire, and Rabbi Shmuel had Mahu Achata, that we have to go out and live in the real world. This goes out and says, I have black fire and white fire and Mahu Achata, and that for the sake, I've always got to go in and play the text, swap with each other for any conclusion. They're not two experiential modes, but I have a library of texts.
You have to deal with all of
them. You have to deal with all of them or justify why you are arranging it the way you are arranging it.
Because
Fort Fakhri can say, look, the bottom line here is that you've got to get up and do this, and it may be the black fire and white fire is an experiential element or an element that I can't make sense of, that my realm today doesn't deal with it. That doesn't mean I want to get rid of it like a 20th century figure.
Or Bakri, do you ever have a text, deal with it, look at it seriously, take it into consideration, and ultimately say, we can't use this?
And ultimately say, we can't use this?
Yes.
For them, yes. For Dulles' misread, no.
Of Bakri?
Of Bakri and Lindbeck. Okay. Dulles' critique of Lindbeck and Fakhri is therefore you're becoming some dogmatic position because you're accepting everything. There I'm going to answer no, I think we're making intelligent choices.
Right, we're going to look at everything, we're not going to misunderstand.
And Dulles says, well, either you're accepting it or you're not accepting it. And I didn't even put that on the bibliography because these are really very sad polemics. Yes.
Is there a point where the idea of making models is not the best idea for us anymore? Like that you just like not to say the symbolic mediation is wrong because whatever politics with the Eliade theology, yeah, whatever we want to talk about, but just the idea, like the very general idea, I have like this discomfort with it. It's like why, if it was good in Revelation, why would you make models of Revelation? Like I don't know how to express it any better.
Okay, so you can formulate that in your paper. I'm a model maker. I will make typologies, categorizations of anything I touch. If you want to find why not, then you get a, and then that could be your paper. Yes.
I still understand how we get out of the question that either of you is that he's being relevant.
Who? Because he's saying that I have a bottom line approach, but the point is we're seeing it with different eyes. The reason that somebody in Renaissance Italy and someone in Poland and someone in America have different narrative structures, different cultural rubrics, and different canons, and will see that same statement of Rabbi Akiva differently, he would say is not to say there is no meaning there. He is to say it is always conditioned by our human experience. You can come back to Mr. Harrison's critique and then say you're putting up an arbitrary wall there. And why don't you go full dimension and go bring out your extremes of your Foucault and everything, but he's not going to do that.
At some point, he might he'll say.
I don't know
what
I said.
It's
just saying.
Okay. Yes.
At some point, he'll say, God does not want you to do that.
That's right.
But it's part of their narrative, literary.
But do not steal in Poland. Do not steal in America. Here, it's embedded within all sorts of thick American practices and what counts and what is legally negligible, and how does it play off of American law, and the fact that how much we already are not mocked it on small amounts, and it would only be in the personal virtue. And the realm is very different than a place where you only own five possessions and do not steal. Meaning, do not steal the worst form of it in Europe was M1. I am stealing your chicken. In America, it is this much more complex. I am quasi-embezzling, I am quasi-shaving off money on my side, I am skimming off the top. And that very definition is not, it's still a do not steal, but the question of my taking your chicken is not the main concern. My concern is how I keep my books.
But
but one of that fits into Christianity beforehand. How does he know it fits into Christianity that way?
Well, then you can read his, you know, his approach. I'm going to let you guys visualize your own Jewish ones.
Is it consistent? Does he end up doing it? Does he really answer the question? Or
does he really answer the question? He does very well. I think he at points, it does come him a little firmer than, once again, he's defending the evangelical. He's a little firmer than we need to be. When your book comes, you can come back and we can...
So you were going to formulate
your mom? Yeah, it's the end. I'm not done. Let's move into the Middle Ages. Okay, first of all, okay, write this down. I'm going to do a little introduction before we start Sadhya. The medievals did not have a problem with revelation at all. They assumed that one of these Sodei Hadat, whether Sadhya or the Rambam, is to believe in Nevuah. And let me give you three things that make that, at least three things that make that understandable. One, they didn't distinguish between human knowledge and divine knowledge. For our medievals under Islam, there was a huge overlap of intuitionism, mysticism, metaconsciousness, contemplation, in which various elements of your human mind at its peak, at its highest, could be called divine. So they weren't fundamentally bothered with a world in which God couldn't enter into it. God was known to them through psychology, through nature, and elsewhere. They all pointed to the divine. Their physics, their biology, their psychology, God was the first cause of everything. So any secular field naturally pointed to God. Two, philosophy and what we would call psychology for them were truer than history or historical study. Meaning if you believe in the power of enlightenment, the power to become a Navi, then the textual issues fall away before that very powerful human capacity. Meaning if I believe in, this is point number two, if I believe in prophecy, then of course I'll work out whatever the textual issues are afterwards. Unlike the 20th century that gave deference to history, sociology, and other fields over religious experience.
Is there an assumption that what they were experiencing wasn't a Nevuah?
Was Nevuah.
Itself, meaning...
Yeah. I mean, they assumed the same way some people have one talent, some people are naturally prophets. It was part of their understanding of the world.
And if that person would get up and say something, you would just have to somehow work it out of the text, but there's no question of it being wrong because of the text.
That's right.
But there are textual proofs brought by various...
But the point is, the starting assumption is that God communicates to humans. Prophecy is a given for them, so therefore questions of text or revelation shy before it. See, 20th century, that doesn't start a given, that assumes that there's such a thing as prophecy, but in the beginning, how do we justify the title is true? They, on the other hand, assume prophecy is real, and therefore, the text of the second question. To give you one of the few places this still exists in the 21st century is when you hear the Dalai Lama or a Buddhist talk. They will talk about enlightenment. They will work out all the questions of scripture and what when a book was edited and where the enlightenment and where Buddha nature fits into the text as an afterthought. But their starting opening presence is enlightenment is possible, Buddha nature is possible. When these Life of Buddha stories were edited as a sideshow to them, what's most important is teaching you how to attain enlightenment. The Spanish Shoshone thought the same way about Navua. Navua is a real part of our life. Mosaic prophecy is the highest level of this Navua. We will worry about the textual issues as a sideshow when we come home.
What are the textual issues?
That's what I'm going to get to that. A third point is that Rishonim, Sadia, and the Rambam assume that the Bible taught scientific and philosophic truth. Further blurring the lines between what they thought they had to justify. Meaning where we may have to think we have to justify, I don't know, Beis Medrash or Mitzvot or whatever we think we have to justify in Revelation, they are, or God or religious experience, they were justifying already the philosophy and science held by many in the culture anyway. The Bible in their read was not a countercultural product.
Because it created the culture?
Yeah, from their point of view, yes.
So, like, are you just saying, like, it's not a joke when they, when Kuzari says, like, all philosophers really saw the dark end of the universe, like, he really believed it.
But that's the only way it could be.
That's right. And unlike your reading an intro to philosophy in which Plato and Aristotle are secular, for Kuzari it's Eloki Aplaton, Eloki Socrates, Eloki Zoroaster, Eloki Hermes. All Greco-Roman world already all believed in God and Revelation in the Kuzari's perspective. He didn't like their view of God and Revelation. He thought it's an unhearing, unmoved God. But he clearly acknowledged that Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Hermes, Zoroaster all accepted God and prophecy. Even if they differed on the details.
It's like a general revelation?
Huh? It's like general revelation. Or to turn it in the other way, the Barthians, the dialectic approach, openly rejected medieval philosophy because they didn't want to have anything to do with natural theology. I am much more comfortable with natural theology in my spending a lot of time reading with Rishonim. Okay? Next, biblical criticism itself. Know that under Islam, there was an Islamic tradition to try to show that the Torah was written by Ezra and that the Jews and Ezra falsified Nevuat Moshe. And that Muhammad had a truer understanding of Moshe than Ezra and the Torah did. But that form of criticism did not make the linchpin to say that the Bible is a secular, human, primitive doctrine, the way much of 20th century wanted to say. The linchpin there was the question of falsification and who had the best Silsila in Arabic, or Shalshelet in Hebrew, who had the best train of tradition for their revelation. Hence, Yehuda HaLevi is going to say, we had the best chain of tradition, and the Muslim critics are going to say, they had the better chain of tradition. But they're not denying the fundamental existence of prophecy. If you want to know more about that, there's a book by Chaya Lazarus Yaffe called Intertwined Worlds, Medieval Islam and Biblical Criticism. And she gives you an overview of this. If you want a, what? Intertwined Worlds. If you want to read a nice Islamic criticism of the Bible, you can go take on Ibn Khazam's criticism of Judaism and Christianity, which got recently fully translated.
And Christianity?
Yeah, because both Jews and Christianity think that the Bible is a better text than the Quran.
When did you write that?
What?
When did you write that?
Ibn Khazam was a contemporary of Chasdai ibn Shaput, so we are in the 9th century, in the 10th century. Yes.
Do they work both ways? Like, if we say, like, yeah, the Quran is, like, not the same as Tanakh, there's still a Kashmir
thing. Did we return the compliment? No. We had very. That's right. We went the opposite extreme, saying that you must be learned and educated, and therefore saying that this book came to be without any knowledge flies in the face of everything we think.
Oh, because Muhammad was illiterate.
Yeah. We go down. We walk down that road.
But that's an inter-Muslim thing also, isn't it? Like,
yes. So the answer is, we do have our statements, we have backhanded statements that can acknowledge Yishmael as being Nidara Chesed and not knowing the proper balance of things. We have, you know, collective statements out there. But we were really fighting for our own Shoshalet. One more thing I want to bring out before we break, even if we go 2 minutes over. Jews did notice the differences of textualities, for example, between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. At some point, I mean, I have a file of lots of these. My usual bekiyot, I have a huge file by now of Rishonim who distinguish between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. But their answers are all predicated on a single nevuah, and the sort of answers that Rishonim give is, for example, Ibn Kaspi will say that Genesis had to start off talking about Yudke Vavke rather than Teva, because even though the world is created with Elohim, which is Teva, but so the Hamonam don't misunderstand and think that there's Shtei Rishuyot, so therefore it had to start with Yudke Vavke. Shari Ora talks about the difference between the first Adam 1 and Adam 2, because they're two different Sefirot, two different levels. Because why does he use a different divine name in the first chapter than the second chapter? What?
Looking at nature of it?
Yeah. So then he didn't want to say that. He wanted to say it's all one. Because he wanted to show you that it's really all one. Shari Auras says it's two different levels. The Rashba explains that Perek Aleph was our ideal state before Chet, before falling from pure intellectuality into physicality, while Perek Bet is already in a post-fall physicality world. So know that what seems to be an insurmountable issue in the 20th century, we've shown in each in their own philosophic, non-historic approach give answers based on the cultural times. And that's where we're going to start next time, using those basic premises with Sadia and Rambam.